From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. China produces more than two-thirds of the world's solar panels. It's led to cheaper production and lower cost for American buyers. Jobs there, manufacturing. Jobs here, installation. What's the bottom line now on solar? For the economy, for our energy needs, for the climate. Who owns the sun? This hour on Point Solar, you can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How do you see solar energy in 2017 and beyond? Does it power your home, your paycheck? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the sound of American energy policy lately. Donald Trump, President Trump, on March 28th, signing an executive order withdrawing from the Obama-era Clean Power Plan, flanked by a group of coal miners. The president made this promise to the workers.
My administration is putting an end to the war on coal. Going to have clean coal, really clean coal. With today's executive action, I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions on American energy, to reverse government intrusion, and to cancel job-killing regulations.
The sound of American energy policy under President Donald Trump. Sound of Chinese energy policy? Here it was from earlier this year from Reuters. The Chinese National Energy Administration pouring huge money into renewable energy to hit new goals by 2020. A major portion of that $360 plus billion headed toward solar.
Last year, China became the world's top solar generator. Beijing says solar power will get the lion's share of the money with a whopping $145 billion.
Lots of resources going toward renewable energy and solar right in the lead, that in China. Joining me now from Shanghai in China via Skype is Keith Bradshaw, Shanghai Bureau Chief for the New York Times, hosts the annual Renewable Energy Conference for the New York Times. He's been writing a lot lately about global solar economics and China's huge role. Keith Bradshaw, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
China has come to absolutely dominate solar panel manufacturing. To what extent and how did that happen?
They now produce two-thirds of the world's solar panels or more, depending on which estimate you look at. And they've gotten to that point because they made a very strategic decision a decade ago that they wanted to have a large industry, globally competitive, that would increase their energy security because they're worried about relying on oil imports from the Mideast and other energy imports. Also, they really had a concern about air pollution, which even a decade ago was becoming a big problem in Chinese cities, and then this is now a terrible problem. And finally, they had an employment concern. They wanted to have a large job-creating industry that would be internationally competitive. And so that's what they set out to do, really in two waves. The first wave was the very, very large government assistance in the setting up of factories all over China with some of the largest scale operations the world, by far the largest scale operations the world seen in solar. And what the Chinese really proved was that you could drive the cost of solar panels way, way down by adopting those kinds of economies of scale. So in the past decade, you've had solar panel prices drop 90%, which is just incredible.
It is incredible.
Then the last 3 years, the second wave of their effort was to subsidize the use of solar energy. So when I started writing about solar panels here in China 6 years ago, they were exporting 95% of annual production. Now, more than half their production is installed at home. They have a lot of subsidies, and they've turned into the world's largest consumer of solar panels as well as the largest producer.
This is, we should step back for just a second and say this is part of a bigger picture, as you report. It's not just solar panels where the Chinese have made a strategic central government decision to go for dominance, which they now have there. Give us a sense of other very significant technologies where the Chinese are aiming to perhaps similarly dominate.
Well, they already have just about the same level of dominance in terms of production and consumption of wind energy. So you have extremely large wind turbine production factories, and you also have gigantic wind farms, mile after mile of these turbines stretching across the desert. I've seen them, whether it's on the edge of Mongolia, whether it's out in near Xinjiang in Gansu province in northwestern China. They have huge wind farms. They have very high capacity transmission lines to bring the electricity in from these windswept desert areas. And at the same time, they've got a lot of economies of scale in terms of very large scale production of wind turbines. Now, there is well, they appear, or they've been judged at least by the Commerce Department and others, to have broken a lot of free trade rules in terms of subsidies in particular, but they have been able to achieve dominance. And then finally, they've also achieved what looks like dominance in technologies that are not renewable energy generation, but related, for example, high-speed rail. So China now has two-thirds of all the tracks in the world of high-speed rail, about 12,000 miles worth. That's enough to go back and forth, to have four transcontinental lines across the United States.
It's worth pointing out, it goes beyond energy and even transportation high-speed rail. They're looking under their Made in China 2025 plan to bulk up in a big time within 7 years in other industries, aircraft, computer chips, robots. We're looking at solar here, and Chinese panels have exploded all over the world and in China. Here's Wei Liang. This is director of the Gaotai Power Plant. He's talking with Euronews. This is last year before, about China's solar ambitions and transforming deserts there into solar energy fields.
This used to be the Gobi Desert. There was nothing here, just stones and wind. The earth wasn't arable. It wasn't profitable. But now it's a treasure.
Sun-filled deserts as a treasure. Keith Brecher, bring it home. I mean, Americans develop solar panels. They still hold lots of patents on solar panels. There was plenty of solar panel manufacturing in this country at one time. Where has that gone, and where are the American jobs in solar now?
You've had wave after wave of layoffs. The first big round of layoffs was in 2012, when the rapid Chinese buildup in production capacity was hitting the market. And you had two dozen European and American companies either close factories or go bankrupt entirely. You did have some companies then that survived, and they filed some anti-dumping and anti-subsidy complaints against the Chinese manufacturers. And that resulted in sort of a pause in the Chinese buildup, but the Chinese switched from subsidizing manufacturers to subsidizing consumers, so then they started using more of the solar panels at home. In the meanwhile, during that pause, the Chinese manufacturers began building factories in places like Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines, and began exporting from them, which bypassed the trade restrictions that had been imposed 5 years ago. So now you've got a second wave of low-cost panels hitting Western markets, and you've had a series of additional layoffs and bankruptcies. The Chinese have also been buying up some of their foreign competitors, so they've bought six American or European solar panel companies in the past, I guess, a little over a year, some of them out of bankruptcy, so it's been pretty inexpensive for them to buy them. You had another bankruptcy just last week, solar panel manufacturer based in the Atlanta suburbs. That panel manufacturer's bankrupt company, although bankrupt, is still operating under Chapter 11, and they filed a trade complaint yesterday, Wednesday, against imports of solar panels. But the question really is going to be whether it's too late for trade policy to make much of a difference. There have been a lot of industries in which you've ended up seeing these kinds of anti-dumping and anti-subsidy complaints, but the usual pattern is that companies tend to be reluctant to spend a lot of money on trade complaints, and they tend to wait until they're so small in terms of economies of scale that they're not necessarily that viable, even when they do get anti-dumping and anti-subsidy protection.
Keith Brecher, stand by there in Shanghai. I want to bring it home a little bit. China really rolling on this front. Two-thirds or more of solar production capacity now manufactured there. China alone buys half of the world's new solar panels now. Effectively, you report, controls the market. Let me turn to New York and David Sandilow. He's fellow at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. David Sandilow, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
We see how the industry is absolutely booming and very much supported by central policy in China. What about in the U.S.? A lot of these manufacturing facilities have closed. What about solar employment here?
it's booming too. You know, it's true that solar manufacturing is challenged in the United States, and manufacturing more broadly is challenged in the United States. But meanwhile, the solar installation business is creating literally hundreds of thousands of new jobs. Last year, there were 260,000 people employed in the solar industry in the United States. Now, today, more than a million homes in the United States have solar. It's growing at record amounts as a result of the price drops, and there's enough solar power in the United States today to power 8 million homes. And all the projections are that that's going to increase. Actually, last year, for the first time, there was more electric capacity added in solar than in any other type of energy source from either natural gas or wind. So the industry is booming in the United States with lots of good jobs, and meanwhile, consumers are saving money. This is being driven by low costs, and maybe the poster child example of this was just last week when the Coal Museum in Kentucky, the National Coal Museum, put solar panels on its roof in order to save energy costs. So this is a wave that's sweeping the United States and that a lot of experts believe is going to continue.
But how far does it go? We just have a minute before the break, but it's only something like, what, 1% of energy production? Is that here or globally comes from solar?
That's correct. It's about 1% in the United States, about 2% globally. So this is a young industry, but it's a young industry with a lot of potential to grow.
What kind of potential? I mean, could it be 10% one day? Could it be half? How much of fossil fuel or wind or other could it actually supplant?
Absolutely. It can. I think projections are that it could easily go to 20 or 30% by mid-century. This is an industry that has a lot of potential to transform the way that power generation works. And in fact, it's already happening.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The sound of solar panels going up right there. China's put up plenty. The U.S. is putting up plenty. They're all over the world. This is in South Africa, solar panels going up. We're talking about solar energy in 2017 and beyond. China, the U.S., the sun. And who's shining these days? Who's claiming the solar future? David Sandilow is with us. He was Undersecretary of Energy, acting and Assistant Secretary for Policy and International Affairs in the Department of Energy from 2009 to 2013. With us from New York today, from Columbia's Center on Global Energy Policy. Keith Bradshaw's here. Shanghai Bureau Chief for the New York Times pays a lot of attention to renewable energy in China and beyond. China becoming a global center of renewable energy, manufacturer of its components in wind and solar, but also the deployment right there. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Will China own the sun? What's the U.S. opportunity here? Are you in the solar business? What do you see? What do you see now? What do you see coming for solar? Lots of folks just going out and doing it. Here's Pat Cannell, retired police officer, Stony Point, New York, put solar panels on his roof.
I needed to save money. I'm a retired police officer. My wife's 70, and we needed to save some cash, and solar is good for the environment. I expect to save probably 25% off my energy bill.
But how far can it really go? And who profits when the solar panels are, at least for now, overwhelmingly made in China? David Sandilow, Keith Bradshaw in Shanghai, stand by. Listeners around the world. John's calling from Puerto Rico, Culebra Island in Puerto Rico. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, well, I've lived on boats in Wisconsin and Florida, and right now I'm on one in Culebra, Puerto Rico. But right now, I have four solar panels, and they're actually, if I was on a dock, but I'm an anchor, I could sell it the extra back to a utility company, because right now it's everything's charged up. But it runs TV, lights, phone, coffee maker, PC, just about everything. Well, everything on the boat. And I want to say to people that have a house and they're worried about how much it costs. Well, most solar panels are guaranteed for 25 years. And so they're going to last forever. There's no moving parts. So you start small. Start with a couple 100s and go from there. You can always add on.
Hey, John, I really appreciate your call, and you make us envious on your boat in Puerto Rico. David Sandilow, speak to that. I mean, John powers his boat. But when you look at the entire American economy or world economy, you're talking about vastly different scale. How far can solar go, and can it go soon enough to make a significant difference in climate change and greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, first, John is just a great example of one area where solar has tremendous potential, which is on islands. In islands in the Caribbean, other places around the world, power is very, very expensive. A lot of times it's being generated by expensive diesel oil that's shipped there. It's also dirty, and solar is just perfect for that type of application. So what John is doing makes a lot of sense. Solar can make a big difference for global warming. There are essentially, on a life cycle basis, there are almost no greenhouse gases that are emitted as a result of solar power. Much, much better than powering our grids with coal, certainly, or even natural gas. So every kilowatt hour that we generate with solar makes a big difference for global warming and also for local air pollution in places like China and India, where that's a big problem.
And long-term scale, how far can this go, how fast, and what difference can it make in the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, greenhouse gases, climate change?
It can make a big difference. Global warming is such a big problem with so many different sources that no single technology is going to solve the problem. Global warming is caused by emissions from cars, from heating, from electricity, and other sources. But solar power can make a big difference, particularly on the electric generation side. And then, by the way, once we get electric vehicles that are powered, that we can plug in, when you plug in your car to a solar panel, you're driving it without generating any pollution as well. So it's there's a lot of potential.
Keith Bradshaw, you write about how at this point, given the scale of its engagement with solar, if China burps, it kind of affects everybody. They just thought about cutting subsidies to, domestic solar panel buyers, people who might put them up in China. And as with that subsidy maybe going away, Chinese manufacturers dropped their prices on solar panels, and that rippled right across the world, right across the U.S., and really knocked more people out of the solar business here. How do you see the long-term dance between China and the U.S. when it comes to solar, Keith? Can it work out to everybody's advantage, or is China somehow a big winner and the U.S. is chasing along?
Well, there are two different levels at which to look at that. The sort of broad level of the environment, as David says, the environment is benefiting from the vast increase in production of solar panels. The fact that solar panel production has gone up, whatever it is, 20-fold in the last decade, has definitely begun to make a real contribution to limiting carbon emissions, begun to make a real contribution to eliminating some of the acid rain and other consequences from burning coal. And while you use numbers like 1 and 2% of power generated, we've also got coal-fired plants that we've been installing for 100 years. We've only the last couple of years really been installing enough solar panels to make a difference. And you keep that up over the next 20, 30 years, and that's converting a sizable chunk of the electricity generation base. And so that's good for the environment. It also creates quite a few jobs in terms of the installation of these solar panels. The only thing that is where China does seem to have a commanding lead is on the manufacturing side, which affects the American trade deficit. It doesn't affect employment. Although even in China, what's surprising is the extent to which they are installing robots. So then you get into a question of whether manufacturing jobs, particularly fairly high-tech jobs, are going to allow for higher incomes longer term than handyman jobs installing solar panels. And you get into a question of sort of who earned more money. Did the oil engineers looking for oil in the Mideast or the gas station attendants who are actually pumping the oil and the gasoline in the United States? It's often there you can get higher paid jobs on the manufacturing side.
But if it comes back to robot manufacturing, couldn't the U.S. bring that home? China, we've been told, has always competed on low wages.
Well, this is the interesting question. Now, that said, while they are using more robots, you get Chinese factories still 3,000 to 5,000 workers.
Wow.
So
yeah.
it's a it's still a big operation. It may not be 7,000 the way it would have been if they'd kept up the same labor to solar panel kind of ratio. But that said, China also is moving extremely fast in the deployment of and development of robots. And that's another goal of Made in China 2025, is to be the dominant producer of industrial robots. The Chinese were allowed by the German government, despite considerable controversy, to buy last summer the world's leading maker of industrial robots. So I've covered the auto industry for the last 20 years, first in Detroit, then here in Asia.
Yep.
And I can tell you the KUKA, K-U-K-A, robots from Germany are everywhere. And now that's now a Chinese-owned company. So they have a lot of expertise in robots. And I had an interesting conversation with the executive vice president of one of the three largest solar panel companies just last month up in Beijing at the National People's Congress. And he said, you know, we will always keep our manufacturing here. We're not going to let it go offshore because we want to have the development of the production processes, the development of ever more efficient solar panels, and the manufacturing all in the same place because they can all learn from each other. So there's a very strong commitment to unifying the initial research, the commercialization of the technology, the mass production, and even in the case of the Chinese, they insist on the mass production of the robots and other equipment that's needed to make it.
It's a kind of a heads-up America, get in the game, stay in the game. David Santillo, how do you see the relationship of these two countries and their economies around the issue of solar? Who profits from the growth of the solar energy industry at large over time, and how we do or do not move toward cleaner energy production. Is this a compatible? Is this a positive relationship between the US and China? Is it a zero-sum winner and loser thing? How do you see it unfolding?
It's a great question, Tom, and the answer is we both profit from the growth of this industry. And I just want to highlight a point that Keith made, that these installation jobs in the United States, these are not going to be outsourced. We have hundreds of thousands of jobs in this industry right now and growing, of people who are installing solar panels and on roofs around the United States and in communities and in big utility scale plants. Those jobs aren't going to go away. Those jobs are growing. And China and the United States, we are the largest developed and the largest developing country in the world. When we work together, the world benefits.
Yeah, but Keith describes this as the American. He describes it as the American installation guys being like the guys who pump gas. I mean, that doesn't sound like the rich end of the stick. Or maybe on the other hand, China makes them cheap, the solar panels. We put them up and make money doing that, and the environment ends up better off. Maybe it is a net win.
Yeah. These are good jobs, Tom. These are good jobs, installing panels, construction jobs, and a lot of Americans right now are paying their bills with this, and a lot more will be in the future. So I think the manufacturing issue that you've been highlighting is an important one. It's, as we said earlier, it's part of a broader challenge. This is not a solar industry specific issue. Manufacturing is challenged on a number of different sectors in the United States. But meanwhile, the growth of the solar industry is not only it's good for job creation. It's good for lowering American electricity bills, as we heard from the New York.
Is it really? Isn't it still subsidized here? Isn't it still subsidized in the U.S.?
It is. There are subsidies. Those are phased out over the course of the next couple of years. And meanwhile, costs are coming down. So,
okay. Mike in Midland, South Dakota. Mike, you're on the air. What do you think?
Well, I think that that there is an opportunity here for a improvement of relations between the United States and China, because I believe that I'm a retired electrician,
okay,
and I understand the job applications that are involved in installing solar panels, and I believe that if we have the opportunity to purchase panels from China at reasonable costs, that we can more than if the administration is interested in creating jobs,
yeah.
And I believe that they are, or at least they say they are. And this is an opportunity. This is absolutely an opportunity because of all of the pluses that are involved in this. There's not only opportunities in localized solar panels. If you look at the onset of electric vehicles coming, you can have solar arrays providing charging power for electrical vehicles installed all over the highway systems.
Yep.
You can have individual solar panels put on the tops of buildings. You can have individual solar panels put on homes. You can also have these huge installations that supply power to the grid, which will demand more transmission lines, which are excellent, great-paying jobs. It's a win-win. I mean,
Mike, we got it. There's the voice of the retired electrician in South Dakota who's looking out, who kind of understands how the whole business works and says, win-win. We're looking at solar energy in 2017 and beyond. Yeah, David, it sounds as though, I mean, if China makes them cheap, okay. Keith says, well, watch out because they're developing expertise in robotics and everything else as they do that massive manufacturing. But maybe right here and now it is a win-win if we can put up those cheap panels and make money doing that and end up with widespread cleaner energy here.
Well, it is, as your caller says, these are jobs for electricians, these are jobs for construction workers, jobs across the economy. And, you know, it brings to mind the famous Wayne Gretzky quote about skating to where the puck is going. The solar industry is where the puck is going. And we should be smart here and make sure that we're orienting our economy and our industry and our policy towards seizing the opportunity there.
What about policy as being made in Washington right now? President Trump has talked a lot about fossil fuels in very favorable terms, in particular about coal, clean, very clean coal. As we heard him say, I don't know if that's true at the top of the hour. But what about policy right now coming out of this White House?
You know, it's been interesting to see how bipartisan the support for solar is. And there's been some interesting survey data, particularly in the southwest United States, pointing to many, if not most, solar owners in some states being politically conservative, not liberal. There used to be kind of an association between solar and hippies and this type of thing. I think that's going away because so many Americans are just buying solar panels just to save energy. The Trump administration has not been negative, especially negative about solar so far. There is a federal tax credit that benefits solar. It has not been on the target list either for the Trump administration or the Republican leadership of Congress to this point. It was passed with a fair amount of bipartisan support a couple years ago. So I think when it comes to skating to where the puck is going, I think it makes sense to keep that in place.
Keith, how are the Chinese looking at that challenge? You talked about the terrible pollution problems that they've had there, and we've all seen them, just hideous. How are they pushing on that front to actually bring down pollution in their own country with renewable, cleaner energy?
They've been trying very hard. They've taken various measures to try to shut down coal-fired plants that are really in the center of the cities, particularly in Beijing. But they know that they need to do a lot more, and that's one reason why they're investing so much in solar panels as something they're installing. It's not just subsidizing the manufacturer the way it was 5 years ago. Now they really are installing them on a large scale. I'd make another point to agree with your caller in Midland, Texas, and also with David. South Dakota. On the value of installing solar panels for the American economy and for American jobs. The rule of thumb in the U.S. Solar industry, at least last I spoke to somebody about this, was that for every $6 you spend on a solar panel system, only $1 is the imported panel. The other $5 are the electrician, the permit process, the building the rack or whatever and attaching it to your roof or whatever it might be. So the panels are a small part of the total cost. For that matter, even in China itself, I wrote my story that I guess started this debate April 8th from Wuhan, and there it's $1 and every $4 is the panel. The other $3 is the local guy in Wuhan who puts up your solar grid for you once you get the panels.
We're going to dive right on in. A little later in this hour, we'll look at the threat of cyber attacks on our energy grids in this country. There's been buzz about that again lately. Keith Bratcher with the New York Times, please stand by in Shanghai. David Sandilow, at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. I know we have to let you go, David. We're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about solar energy in 2017, right now and beyond. Looking at China, the U.S., the sun, and who's shining these days? Who's claiming the solar future? Maybe everybody. China is certainly pushing very hard on this front, as we've heard a lot of talk in this country lately about coal and so on. What's your experience with solar? What are your expectations looking forward? And what do you think about this balance of power or production or pioneering between China and the United States? Keith Bradshaw is with us from Shanghai in China via Skype, Shanghai bureau chief of the New York Times, who's paid a lot of attention to this. Keith, I mean, people have come up along with China's boom of the last couple of decades, almost out of nowhere. You tell the story of one Mr. Liu who began raising pigs and then raising fish and turned into a solar mogul.
Yes, he's quite an extraordinary story. He had studied the science, as it were, of fish farming, going to a vocational high school, and he started raising fish after he graduated from high school. This is now 30 years ago. He realized that what really would make a difference was how you sort of netted them off the fish farming area within the river. And then he decided, well, the real way to make money was to be selling the fish feed. And he sold the family pigs, managed to get started in business, quickly built an empire within a decade selling fish feed and then duck feed. He had his own brand. But then he started looking around. What can I look into next? And he ended up deciding he wanted to get into solar panels. Brilliant timing. He started getting into the raw material, polysilicon, 2004. And so then he was already, when the government in the next couple of years decided it wanted to really ramp up production of solar panels itself, he jumped into solar panel production. And then he expanded greatly in the downturn in 2013 when the U.S. and the Europeans imposed trade sanctions. He was able to buy a factory, a big solar panel factory, inexpensively, and he's been growing ever since.
So there you go, from pig farmer and fish food manufacturer to solar mogul pretty fast right there in China. John in Bridgeport, Connecticut. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've been in the industry for a number of years. I'm also a solar consumer. I have it on my house for a number of years. And yes, I just wanted to, you know, come out full on, obviously very positive about solar. And I see, I almost can't imagine how the limitlessness of the solar industry and also the flywheel effect that it gives to other contractors. I'm showing up at a job site right now where I've got pavers because we did a carport in a parking lot, so we're paving there. We also had carpenters working because we built this carport out of wood, just left the site up in Bristol where, you know, we had to take a few trees down to do a ground mount, so we hire those guys. I'll be in Greenwich tomorrow lifting two projects, working with a crane and also electricians to do the tie-in. So I hear so much doom and gloom in the news and everywhere, and I have to tell you that, I made a decision to get into solar about 20 years ago, and it's been a unbelievable, they call it the solar coaster for good reason, but it's been just a wild ride and fantastic all around, and I see nothing but positive coming up in the future. I mean, our business model is the sun comes out and we make money. So why people wouldn't want to get on board with that is mind-boggling.
John, do you care where the solar panels come from? Sounds like you're installing them. Do you care where they come from?
I don't necessarily care so much where they come from because the jobs, as your previous callers or panel have said, these jobs to install them are the higher paying local jobs. Again, tradesmen, tradespeople that are here in the United States. These jobs can't be exported. I've worked with some great companies over the years, SolarCity, Sunrun, and I have to tell you, to each company I've worked with, they collect I-9s, and I was a hiring manager, collecting I-9s, making sure safety was a top priority. I don't think you'll find a safer industry than the solar industry, and we deal with, you know, obviously people on roofs, people doing electrical work.
Sure.
The potential is there for dangerous, but super safety has been, you know, a big goal in the industry.
And you say bring it on, John, and don't really care where the panels come from. If they're cheap, I guess it just makes it cheaper to put them in. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here. Eric in Harvard, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm in Harvard, Mass., where we have one of the state's first member-owned community shared solar installation, and it really is great for people who can't have it on their roofs. And we could talk more about that, but many of us who have been doing solar advocacy understand that the real key to making for a cleaner power sector and removing fossil fuel from that is storage. You can't replace base load on the grid solar during the night. And so there still has to be fossil fuel capacity, you know, plants. And we really need storage in order to clean up the grid.
And by storage, you mean batteries. And that's been the thing. I mean, new kinds of batteries, big batteries that could store a whole enormous solar charge. Eric, I'm glad you raised it. Keith Bradshaw, what about in China? They must be focused on this side as well. No one's really unlocked that knot yet. Do they have an angle on how to develop batteries big and with enough storage capacity to grab that solar power and hang on to it for times when the sun's not shining?
They are working very hard on it. You have some absolutely enormous battery factories being built right now in China, particularly in Western China. And again, it's one of these difficult questions where, on the one hand, it's probably good for the world if the Chinese can manage to dominate this technology, and it is one of their industrial priorities. On the other hand, it could end up with the world being dependent on Chinese batteries as well. But they are building with again government backing. They are once again building just gigantic projects right now to try to, in the hopes that they can get more economies of scale in batteries. Now, battery prices are not going to come down 90% over a decade the way solar panels did, because the materials costs are a fairly high proportion of the total cost of the battery, and those material costs are not going to go away. They've even tried things like they're building new factories near the lithium mines in Western China, but they are trying, and there's progress being made in that area in China as well.
I mean, you quote a distributor of panels in the U.S. in Eugene, Oregon, saying that the Chinese will crush American manufacturers of solar panels, and already have in many ways. Over time, just got you for another minute here, Keith. How do you see this relationship playing out, the U.S. and China around solar?
Well, I think that China has done the world a service in the sense that it has made it possible to have inexpensive, affordable solar power, and it has created a lot of jobs in the United States among electricians and contractors. It's unfortunate that the U.S. couldn't manage to have the growth in the manufacturing side as well. But certainly solar is not the only manufacturing sector in which the United States has struggled to compete lately.
You think this one can end up a win-win for the U.S. and China?
Very hard to say. We'll have to watch and see where the trade issues go. But certainly it's been a win-win at least for China, in the sense that they've got a very large job-creating industry, and they are doing something to address their energy import needs and their pollution problems. And their energy security issues. So it's been a total win-win for China, and in some ways it's been a win-win for the United States as well.
The U.S. installing a lot of those low-cost panels right now. Keith Bradshaw, Shanghai Bureau Chief for the New York Times, joining us today from Shanghai. Keith, it's always great talking with you. Thank you very much for your reporting and for being with us, Keith.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, cyber threats on U.S. national energy grids. This is On Point. Last week, rolling blackouts hit California. The first thought for many was cyber attacks on the energy grid. What turned out to be caused simply by a fire still got people thinking, what are the risks of cyber attack when it comes to our energy grid, and are we prepared for them? We've been hearing more and more about that concern. Joining me now from Arlington, Virginia, is John Everett, Program Manager for the Information Innovation Office at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. He heads a program called RADx, Rapid Attack Detection, Isolation, and Characterization Systems. That sounds very exotic. James Bondi develops technologies to detect and respond to cyber attacks on infrastructure such as energy grids. John Everett, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Why do you think this is suddenly so much on people's minds? I mean, the blackout hit San Francisco, and the first thing people think of is, oh my gosh, have we got a cyber attack here?
Well, of course, there were sirens going off in the middle of the night in Dallas, and that was traced to a cyber attack. And so I think it's just in the news now. We also had the Mirai botnet last fall, which took down the internet temporarily on the East Coast.
So what is the vulnerability of our electric grid to cyber attack and bringing it down?
Well, in order to have affordable power in a nation the size of the United States, we have to have automation. And as we start to put automation in, the initial thought is, wow, it works at all. There's less thought about building in security. And so we have a system which has increasingly been taking advantage of the networked cyber systems that we have, but that makes it available to potential hackers.
Networked cyber systems, explain what you mean there. How does automation work off of cyber systems or the internet at this point?
Well, so the internet forms the basis for all of our communication. So all of our telephones for now, for example, go over the internet. And so it's available. It's available everywhere. And it's the least cost way to connect a remote substation to the central control station where they can control the power grid. Much more efficient than having individuals at every substation.
So you're just simply talking about when to crank up transmission of electricity in this or that locale around the country?
Yes, essentially. The electric power grid is this machine which is distributed across the entire country. So anytime you're driving along and you see high tension wires or a power station in the distance, you're only seeing a very small percentage of the total machine. It's hard to get a sense of the scale of it. But yes, essentially the control of the power grid is turning things on and off as the day progresses, as the weather heats up and air conditioning comes on, people demand more electricity. So the utilities are constantly balancing the generation of power against the demand.
So a cyber attack would be something like, well, turn it off, turn the power off. That order would go out over internet lines and down they would come. Could they say, turn it off and lock it up? Are we talking physical destruction here or simply a knot of malicious commands?
Well, it could range. So, for example, somebody could potentially get in, as they did in the Ukraine, and start flipping breakers off and turning things off, and then making it hard for the utility engineers to turn things back on. Now, that wasn't a very long-lived outage. It lasted for a few hours. There is the potential for somebody to do more damage, depending on how much effort they put into their attack.
It looks to me as though our vulnerability may be growing because this automation is growing. More and more of our grid is internet controlled. Does that mean more vulnerability?
Well, that's really why we're running a program in this area. You know, our job is to anticipate technological threats, and we believe that may be the case as we move forward. We're going to have increasingly networked systems. Then we need to figure out ways in which to appropriately defend them.
This has already been tested, right? I mean, we saw hacking last fall with pretty big effect.
That's true. I mean, certainly in the Ukraine in the December of 2015 and December of 2016, there was actually a real-world test of it, if you will.
And in the U.S.?
In the U.S., we don't have anything. We're really seeing more of the nuisance things like the Dallas sirens. There's nothing that I'm aware of where there was actually a deliberate cyber attack on the power grid. There are plenty of outages that are caused by simply equipment being old and breaking, and sometimes it is hard to disentangle the causality. But we don't know that there's been any deliberate attempt on the grid at this point.
Is there evidence of people poking around in the cyber support system of our electrical grid, hackers poking around?
Yeah, there seems to be some evidence of that. It's hard to tell if somebody knows even that they're in a power grid. In other words, hackers are constantly poking at computer systems all the time. Do they know if they're in a bank's computer or a power grid's computer? Sometimes they do, maybe they don't.
We've heard in the last week people saying, well, you know, North Korea or Iran, if things got feisty with the U.S., they could get in and attack the U.S. power grid. Does that make sense to you? Would these be countries that would have that kind of capacity?
It's hard to say for sure. It's possible. And so it's a possibility to treat with some concern.
How do you protect such a distributed system? We know the internet is highly hackable. I mean, your job is to figure out how to counter this. How do you begin to do it?
Well, so there are, I mean, we are certainly not the only people to have become aware of this, you know, this issue over the past, say, decade. And so we're seeing a number of startup companies and more mature companies that have been working in traditional cybersecurity. They're starting to bring more and more products to market, and utilities are starting to deploy better defensive measures. There's the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, which enforces some standards on utilities. They are partially regulated. And so those standards are starting to really produce effect. So the defensive posture of utilities is already improving. What we're looking at is, well, what if there really was a very determined adversary and they managed to punch through these defenses? What could we do to recover power rapidly? After all, if we can bring the power back on pretty quickly, then we really make the net effect of the attack fairly minor.
It sounds, though, like it could be tied up down for a long time. Is that the case right now?
Well, I mean, so in a severe weather event like Sandy, for example, the hurricane that hit the Northeast, that brought power down for a couple of weeks. So people managed to weather it. I'm sure it was very unpleasant for people in those situations. But we're pretty resilient as a whole. So even if we ended up in a situation, I'm confident that we have the engineering capability to be able to bring power back in that same time frame.
We've got our fingers crossed for you and your work, John Everett, at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. Thank you very much for being with us, John.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.